Lecture 22, Women and Jewish Law.
The subject of this lecture is women and Jewish law. What we're really going to be doing throughout this lecture is looking at how certain laws have developed from the biblical period through the rabbinic period and the medieval period up to the modern period. But we're going to be using as our case studies laws of particular relevance to women. Men are also concerned about these issues, but I wanted to dedicate at least one of our lectures to Judaism's relationship to women. If we go back to the Hebrew Bible itself, the role and the position of women is not always what a modern feminist might like it to be. Let me give you an example from Exodus chapter 19. This is the chapter where God is talking to Moses about preparing the people for revelation, for the giving of the Decalogue in a few days. Exodus 19 verse 10 says, "The Lord said to Moses, 'Go to the people and warn them to stay pure today and tomorrow. Let them wash their clothes. Let them be ready for the third day. For on the third day, the Lord will come down in the sight of all the people on Mount Sinai.'" So now let's see what Moses actually says in verse 14. "Moses came down from the mountain to the people and warned them to stay pure, and they washed their clothes. And he said to the people, 'Be ready for the third day. Do not go near a woman.'" So if Moses is saying, "Do not go near a woman," it seems as though he is speaking only to the men. So does that mean that the women weren't included in the revelation of God at Mount Sinai? Part of the reason I wanted to focus in on laws related to women is to see how this group, 50% of the kingdom, to quote the book of Esther, is treated not so much in the narrative of the Hebrew Bible, but throughout the halakha within Judaism. Because in some ways, women are the other within Judaism. So let's begin our examination by taking a look at the laws regarding marriage and divorce within the Torah itself. There is a bride price when one wants to get married that the groom pays to the father of the bride in order to cement the relationship. The bride also comes into the marriage with a dowry. Once they're married, the husband is responsible for, according to Exodus 21:10, the husband is responsible for food, clothing, and most translations say conjugal rights. In other words, the husband has an obligation to satisfy his wife sexually. Now, if you're thinking about the three things that a man is responsible for when he takes a wife, food, clothing, and the next word that falls off my tongue is shelter, right? Food, clothing, and shelter, not food, clothing, and conjugal rights. And indeed, we have a medieval commentator, Rashbam, from the 12th or 13th century in France, who says, no, we really should understand that word as shelter, not conjugal rights, which makes it all the more interesting why the rabbis who interpreted this word as conjugal rights did so perhaps against the grain of the contextual reading. Perhaps shelter was taken for granted, but what's not taken for granted is that the husband has certain sexual obligations to his wife. Why is that so important in the biblical period and in the rabbinic period? Because a husband can have multiple wives, according to the Torah. One man can have any number of wives, but a woman can only have one husband. So if the man is tending to or favoring his third, fourth, and fifth wife, it might mean his first and second wife are being neglected. Well, that's not fair to them because they have no other avenue of satisfying their own needs. So the rabbis made sure that anybody who took a wife would need to tend to their food, clothing, shelter is taken for granted, as well as conjugal rights. How does divorce happen in the Torah? If the man finds something, anything, objectionable about the woman, he has the sole prerogative to issue the writ of divorce. When the woman leaves the relationship, she takes her dowry with her, and there the marriage ends. Okay. Now let's see what innovations we find in the rabbinic period. The rabbis instituted a document called the ketubah, which literally means something written. Lichtov means to write. But this prenuptial agreement, or this wedding contract, greatly enhanced the rights of women. No longer were funds given to the father of the bride at the time of the marriage. The ketubah stipulates that a minimum amount of money will be provided to the woman upon divorce or the death of the husband. Thus, we see the shift from a purchase, where in the biblical period the groom would pay the father of the bride, to a process of negotiation requiring the woman's consent. Also, by deferring the financial burden of the bride price to either the death of the husband or the dissolution of the marriage, it allowed poor men to marry who might otherwise not have been able to raise the bride price. So that's a good thing in the eyes of the rabbi. If more men can marry, more women can be married, and they can start families earlier. Furthermore, by deferring this financial burden, it has the effect of inhibiting rash divorces. Think about the logic there. Now the husband has something to lose by divorcing his wife. He has to pay the amount stipulated in the ketubah. But if, in the biblical period, if a man decides to divorce his wife, she leaves, he loses nothing but the dowry that she had brought into the marriage to begin with. So this situation, interestingly enough, differs from biblical laws we've seen, but also from Roman law that was current at the time that the rabbis made these innovations. The rabbis also instituted an additional series of responsibilities to protect the wife. Among them, should the woman be taken captive, the husband must redeem her. This reminds me of a scene from Ruthless People when the character played by Danny DeVito finds out that his wife, played by Bette Midler, has been kidnapped. He celebrates, he laughs, he dances, he sings, he pops open a bottle of champagne. Thank goodness somebody else has taken her off his hands. That's okay to do in Judaism, but eventually you have to redeem her, according to the stipulations of the ketubah. You can't just leave her at the mercy of her captors. Also, should the woman be taken ill, the husband must provide her with medical care. If she dies before her husband, her sons will inherit the funds from the ketubah as well as her dowry. And if she outlives her husband, she can either maintain herself from his estate indefinitely so that she doesn't have to be thrown out into the cold wild, or she can take her ketubah and start her new life over again. Divorce in the rabbinic period. Unlike men, women must receive a bill of divorce before remarrying. If it's a man doesn't have to receive a bill of divorce because he can marry as many women as he wants. But the woman can only be married to one person at a time, so she's got to receive that writ of divorce, which in Hebrew is called a get. She needs to receive that get in order to be eligible to marry another man. So monogamy is certainly the ideal in the biblical world as well as in the rabbinic world. Is monogamy an ideal in the biblical world? I'm not sure. Let me take that back. With Moses, no one imagines that Moses was a bigamist. But if you read Numbers chapter 12, it seems as though Moses had taken an additional wife, a Cushite. But we know that Moses had taken Jethro's daughter, Zipporah, as a wife, and she was a Midianite. So Moses was a bigamist. But the rabbis bend over backwards to read those verses in Numbers that describe Moses taking a Cushite wife as Zipporah, which means that the rabbis were very uncomfortable with Moses, their hero, being a bigamist. So for certain, in the rabbinic period, the ideal was monogamy. But polygyny is a biblical institution. Polygyny, a man marrying multiple wives, is a biblical institution that was temporarily suspended by four Ashkenazi Jews, those Jews in Europe, about 1,000 years ago, but it's still on the books. Although technically the husband initiated the divorce, the rabbis, during the rabbinic period, they found ways of protecting a woman from a recalcitrant husband in order to prevent women from becoming agunot. Literally, agunot means chained down, anchored, right? We, in English, we call them straw widows. The rabbis were concerned that women wouldn't be able to remarry again unless their husbands gave them a get. So sometimes the rabbis forced men to voluntarily, in quotes, issue their wives a get or the writ of divorce. Other times rabbis annulled the marriage altogether, thus freeing the woman to marry another man even without a get. Now, both of those solutions to the problem of an agunah, or an anchored woman, a straw widow, were not very popular, and they were exercised less and less as we move into the Middle Ages and into the modern period, so that rabbinic authorities weren't willing to apply physical force to make the husband divorce the woman or to sign a get, nor were they willing to annul the divorce. But now we move into the contemporary world, and we look at rabbinic mechanisms, really in the last 20 years, that are put in place in order to further fairness toward women. So some rabbis have husbands or the fiancés, before they get married, sign a get, right? Even at the time of the marriage, that they, the rabbis, keep in their possession, should the marriage effectively come to an end. So the woman in a marriage that's effectively come to an end can go to the rabbi and say, you know what, I'm ready for a divorce, he won't give me the get, you've got the get, please give it to me. Although this works really well for soldiers who are going off to war, who might be missing in action, and therefore you don't know if they're dead or alive and they're not around to sign a get, for others it just makes getting a divorce too easy since all the paperwork has been completed. This practice actually goes back to the rabbinic period also. Another attempt at making things more fair for women is the Lieberman Clause, named after a scholar, a Talmudic scholar who taught at JTS, the Conservative Seminary, for many years. The Lieberman Clause is a clause that's actually written into the ketubah itself, and it authorizes a court to force, through excessive monetary sanctions, a divorce. But again, this also doesn't have the kind of binding power that would necessarily compel a man to issue his wife a get. Another option, the Orthodox Rabbinical Council of America and the Conservative Rabbinical Assembly, they use a similar strategy, but with a separate document outside of the ketubah. Leave the text, the traditional text of the ketubah alone, have the husband sign another document agreeing that he'll pay excessive monetary sanctions in the event that the marriage has effectively come to an end. Same kinds of problems as we mentioned above. The most recent Orthodox attempt to deal with the problem of agunot is one by Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, who suggested that annulment be rehabilitated in order to persuade men to stop blackmailing their wives. Blackmailing their wives? Some men, when they're in a marriage that's gone south, they tell their wives, hey, I'm not going to give you a get so that you can move on with your life unless you pay me $10,000. In that kind of a circumstance, the woman is stuck. If she doesn't pay the money, she remains anchored to this man. Rabbi Riskin is familiar with this problem, and is sympathetic to these agunot, so he wants to rehabilitate this idea of annulling the marriage retroactively in order to deal with those kinds of men, and also to free women from recalcitrant husbands, even if they're not trying to blackmail their wives. So we see in the modern period a variety of attempts in the Orthodox world and in the conservative world, those denominations who still take halakha as binding in order to further fairness toward women. Okay, let's take a look at the issue of abortion or feticide. The biblical text that begins our discussion is found in Exodus chapter 21, verses 22 and 23. When men fight and one of them pushes a pregnant woman, and a miscarriage results, but no other damage ensues, the one responsible shall be fined according as the woman's husband may exact from him, the payment to be based on reckoning. But if other damage ensues, namely if the woman dies, if the pregnant woman dies, that's the other damage that would ensue, the penalty shall be life for life. So what this means is that according to the Bible, a fetus doesn't have the legal status of a full life. Because if it did, then the reckoning would be life for life. But if just a miscarriage results and the woman doesn't die who was pushed, then it's monetary compensation. You only have the case of life for life when you have the case of manslaughter, unintentional homicide, when the two men are fighting, the pregnant woman is pushed, and in addition to the fetus dying, the woman dies. Then you have the case of life for life. This informs the Jewish discussion of abortion. According to the Bible, the fetus does not have the full legal rights of a living being. Is this talking about abortion? No, this is not talking about abortion. But the rabbis will use this case in order to inform their decisions and their discussions about abortion. Now let's take a look at that first layer of Jewish law in the Mishnah. If a woman is having difficulty in labor, one cuts up the fetus within her womb and extracts it limb by limb, because her life takes precedence over that of the fetus. But if the greater part is already born, and in other manuscripts of the Mishnah, if the head and shoulders of the fetus, so that it's not a breech baby, if the greater part is already born, one may not touch it, for one may not set aside one person's life for another. So what does this mean? That until the fetus has the majority of its body out, head and shoulders, it doesn't have the status of a full human being. Therefore, if the woman is in difficulty, only if the woman is in difficulty during this labor process, then the Mishnah is very clear. You extract the fetus, even if you need to cut it up limb by limb, in order to save the woman's life. She has the full status of a living being. The fetus doesn't have a full status, doesn't have the full status of a living being until the majority of its body is outside of the woman's body. But once that happens, then you try to save them both, and you do whatever you can to try to save both. Okay, how does that law develop once the medical technology and know-how gets to be sophisticated enough to allow for elective abortions? In the 17th century, several rabbis permitted elective abortions based on mother's need and mother's healing, which included psychological factors. Now, here's how they did it. It says in the Mishnah, if the woman is having difficulty in labor, well, it has to be, the only way to justify an abortion in Judaism is if the woman is having difficulty. But it doesn't necessarily explicitly say that she's having physical difficulty. It might be psychological difficulty. And let me give you an example, the examples that the rabbis were dealing with. If a woman has been raped, and having that child would be very difficult for her because the child would be illegitimate, then the rabbis will sanction or tolerate an abortion. Similarly, if the woman has, in a moment of indiscretion, had an extramarital affair, she's committed an act of adultery. Similarly, her product, her child, would be illegitimate. The rabbis will allow her to abort such a fetus because of the psychological factors on the mother based on their rereading of this Mishnah. As we move into the 20th century, we have advances in medical technology. Abortion has been permitted to those for whom the knowledge of having a Tay-Sachs baby, a genetic disease that is particularly prominent within the Ashkenazi Jewish population, if the woman knows that her baby, as a result of genetic testing, is going to have Tay-Sachs and is going to end up dying very quickly after birth, and that knowledge is traumatic to the woman, that maternal indicator, for at least one school of rabbinic thought, will allow the woman to have an abortion. Okay, so let's now try to wrap up this discussion of Judaism and abortion. I want to quote from a conservative rabbi who teaches at the University of Judaism, Rabbi Elliot Dorf. He writes that Jewish law requires abortion when the woman's life or health, physical or mental, is threatened by the pregnancy. Jewish law requires, okay? Jewish law permits abortion when the risk to the woman's life or health, again, physical or mental, is greater than that of a normal pregnancy, but not so great as to constitute a clear and present danger to her. This means that the terminology we use in American political discourse of pro-choice and pro-life is simply inapplicable in the world of Judaism. Because if the woman's health is in danger, not the rabbi, but the doctor, if her physical health is in danger, then the doctor has to make a split-second decision that her life takes precedence over the fetus's. It's not her choice. Abortion has to be allowed, but it's not the woman's choice. And let's say that we're talking about mental anguish, psychological distress. The woman goes to the rabbi to ask whether or not she can abort this child who's going to be a Tay-Sachs child. And the rabbi says, well, does it really bother you that you're going to have a child that's going to end up dying? Theoretically, the woman could say, no, if that's God's will to give me a child that has a degenerative disease and will relatively quickly die, then I accept that from God. In that situation, the woman isn't undergoing any distress, and the rabbi couldn't allow her to have an abortion. But if the woman comes to the rabbi and is pulling out her hair and says, I just can't imagine giving birth to this creature that is going to slowly die before my eyes in such a short time. In that case, there are maternal indicators of psychological distress, and the rabbi can allow her to have an abortion. So, but in neither case is it the woman's choice. So that's why these labels of pro-choice and pro-life don't quite work in Judaism. Fred Rosner has the following sentence, which I think nicely sums up the issue of Judaism and abortion. Legal permissibility is not synonymous with moral license. So just because there's a dispensation or there's an allowance to have an abortion doesn't mean that you can do that without approaching it with, in the words of one rabbi, solemn hesitation. Solemn hesitation. Okay. The final example of women in Jewish law that we're going to look at is women in communal leadership roles. In the biblical world, there were always individuals like Sarah and Miriam and Deborah and Yael who had charisma and were lifted up by the community to lead the community in certain situations. And that happened in the rabbinic period. We know of a few women that seemed to be very learned and seemed to command the respect of the community, also in the Middle Ages. But nothing institutional. That was all on an individual level. Those were the exceptions. And it was generally, the rule was, it was the men who were the leaders of the community. The first woman to receive private, not institutional, but private, rabbinic ordination was a woman in Germany by the name of Regina Jonas. This was in 1935, and she received smicha, or ordination, from a reform-leaning rabbi. Jonas was German and a graduate of the liberal seminary in Berlin. She did study, but the seminary didn't give her ordination. It was through a private individual rabbi. After the Nazis came to power, she was sent to Theresienstadt in Czechoslovakia and eventually to her death at Auschwitz. So Regina Jonas is the first woman to get private ordination, but we have to wait several decades until an institution gives women ordination. And we see that within the reform movement. In 1972, really as a result of the feminist influence that swept over the United States as well as Western Europe in the 60s and 70s, a woman named Sally Priesand became a reform rabbi. For the reform movement, egalitarianism was an issue of fairness. If men can become rabbis, why shouldn't women become rabbis? Therefore, let's make women rabbis. It was almost that simple. The discussion was similarly simple for Reconstructionists, and they began ordaining women in 1975. For the conservative movement, ordaining women as rabbis wasn't so simple. It involved a halachic hurdle because ordaining women had never been done. There were some halachic problems with it, and those halachic problems needed to be addressed. This came to a head in the 80s. Professor Joel Roth was one of the members of the law committee for the conservative movement, and he argued that today, women are competent in legal and business issues, which had not been the case in the rabbinic period. Very often, what a rabbi is asked to do is to make a judgment about a legal issue that involves business. Well, if women don't know anything about business, then you can't expect them to be competent to make a judgment. But today, it's not the case that women are incompetent about business issues. I went to the Wharton School of Business, and half the class was female. Right? Women know law and women know business practices as well as men. So that was the first part of his argument, that there's no reason now to prevent women from exercising their judicial opinion. But there was another part of the argument, that women in Judaism don't have the same responsibilities as men, and therefore they don't have the same rights as men. Traditionally, Jewish women have been exempt from most positive, time-bound commandments, such as praying three times a day with a group. It was understood 2,000 years ago that women had other things to do, namely to take care of their nursing babies or their children. They had responsibilities at home. So if the commandment involved something that they had to do at a certain time, they were exempt from that, because what if what they had to do at a certain time couldn't wait? It was time sensitive because they had to take care of the needs of their family. Well, today women are freed to a large extent from those kinds of time-sensitive needs. And so if women are willing to take on those responsibilities that men have, then they can also assume the rights that men have. And therefore, women can become rabbis. So it was a two-part teshuvah, or rabbinic decision. A, women have the capability of doing it, and B, women who take on the responsibilities of the male Jew in terms of davening or praying three times a day and all of the other commandments, then they will similarly have the rights that men have to be leaders in the community. So women began being ordained in the conservative movement in 1985. Now, over the last 20 years, there have been incredible strides made for women in Orthodoxy as well. There aren't institutions, there aren't Orthodox institutions like Yeshiva University ordaining women, but there already has been an Orthodox woman, Mimi Feigelson, who was given private ordination in Israel, and she is now teaching at the University of Judaism in Los Angeles. In addition to that path-breaking move, there are women's yeshivot, places for women to do serious Jewish text study and serious Talmud study on very high levels. There are women's prayer groups where women conduct services without male support. There's one women's yeshiva in Jerusalem, Nishmat, that began in 1997 training their women to be halachic advisors for certain legal issues specific to women. And already we know about a handful of women who are studying for Orthodox rabbinic ordination, although to my knowledge, none has been ordained with the exception of Mimi Feigelson. So we have female rabbinic assistants today, and the issue of female rabbis is on the Orthodox table. Now that we've taken a look at the other within Judaism, our next lecture will focus on the other outside of Judaism, how Judaism responds to non-Jews and Christians in particular.